Richard Ford, the self-avowedly ill-tempered author of Canada and the sports writer, once kicked me in the shin. While I would like to be able to persuade myself and others that his kick was the result of a jealous rage brought on by reports of my skill as a prose stylist, the truth is much less dramatic. The prize-winning author happened to be sitting beside me at a Michael Longley poetry reading in a lecture theatre where there was very little legroom. As we waited for the reading to begin, he twisted himself several times in his seat in an effort to get comfortable, crossed his legs vigorously, and in the process whacked my right shin. He apologised profusely. I assured him there was no lasting damage. But then, as I'd never before found myself sitting beside a world-renowned writer, let alone being kicked by one, a certain headiness overcame me. I seized upon his accidental assault as the perfect opportunity to engage him in conversation. Sadly, the very second I leaned across to tell him how much I admired his work was also the very second that Michael Longley chose to begin his reading. Richard Ford signalled to me by means of a discreetly raised hand that he'd much prefer to listen to Longley than to me. My moment was gone. The ship had sailed. My life is full of such incidents, close encounters of the deeply unsatisfying kind, unlikely meetings with the talented and famous that lead to nothing but disappointment. If it's true that there's a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune, I seem to specialise in missing that tide. My most recent failed encounter occurred right in front of my house. The refuse bins had just been emptied, and I was about to wheel our bin in off the footpath when I was approached by a sharply dressed man in his late 50s. He was sporting a pencil moustache, wearing a snow-white baseball jacket set off by an oversized bright red French beret, and eating a bar of chocolate. He seemed oddly familiar. He asked if it would be okay if he threw his chocolate wrapper in my bin. Something about the voice helped me place him. Kevin Rowland of Dexy's Midnight Runners. Of course, I replied. I'd be delighted to be able to tell people that Kevin Rowland once used my bin. He seemed pleased to be recognised. After a few pleasantries, he asked if there was a nice boozer in the area. I directed him to Slattery's down the road. I'll buy you a drink if you like, he said, in return for the bin. Not at all, you're grand, I said, a little embarrassed at the idea that he felt he needed to repay me for putting a wrapper in my bin. He headed off towards the pub. I headed back into the house. It took only about a minute for me to realise the enormity of my folly. I had turned down the chance to have a one-on-one drink with Kevin Rowland. I grabbed my jacket and headed for Slattery's. By the time I got there, however, it was too late. Another opportunity had just floated away on the tide. Whether it was his eye-catching red beret or the snow-white jacket, word had somehow got out that there was a celebrity in the house. Kevin Rowland was surrounded by 10 or 12 ageing fans, all of whom had once probably danced to Dexy's in their youth, and who, unlike me, were enjoying the experience of having a close encounter of a deeply satisfying kind. Another meeting that seemed to promise so much occurred about 10 years ago. Walking through the Lower East Side of Manhattan, my wife, son and I came across a film crew at the corner of Orchard Street and Broome Street. Technicians were adjusting lights while the director and two or three actors huddled over a monitor. We joined a few curious onlookers on the pavement opposite. Eventually, one of the actors detached himself from the group. looked around as if searching for someone in particular, spotted us, and walked over to me. It was Willem Dafoe. He asked if we were all one family, nodding at my wife and son, and if we'd like to be in the movie. Visions of red carpets, Oscars, and champagne-filled baths flashed before my eyes. Sure, I said, we'd love to. He introduced us to the director, Abel Ferrara, perhaps best known for The Bad Lieutenant, a dark 1992 police drama starring Harvey Keitel. Ferrara explained that this was a movie about the end of the world. All we had to do was walk quickly across the street, looking concerned, but not frightened. We composed our features into what we hoped was a look of concern that somehow did not tip over into fear. We walked across the road. Abel Ferrara wasn't happy. We weren't concerned enough. We walked across again. Willem Dafoe wasn't happy. Somebody behind us had waved at the camera. We walked across the road again, and again, and again. Finally, I think Ferrara got tired. He thanked us and told us we were amazing. The movie was going to be called 444, Last Day on Earth, he said, and we should go see it as soon as it hit the movie theatres. Predictably, given that it was my only chance to make it in Hollywood, the film never received a cinema release. It went straight to DVD, but even the DVD seemed to be unavailable in Europe. Recently, my son came across an online version of it in some obscure corner of the internet and reported that, equally predictably, we were not in the final edit. No matter, my Hollywood career may still be lying discarded on Abel Ferrara's cutting room floor, but I'll just wait for the next high tide.
Fame will eat the soul and you just can't fake it.
A couple of weeks ago, I had an email from a friend, a man I'd been in school with more than 50 years ago. In the course of that letter, he referred to an occasion, one that I'd forgotten, when he was humiliated by a teacher. The man had slapped him across the back with his walking stick as he knelt at the blackboard writing lines. It wasn't the pain of the stick on his back that he remembered, but the greater pain of his awareness of dust rising from the second-hand jacket his parents had bought for him for school. He wrote of how he remembered the dust motes rising in the sunny air of the classroom, and of the deep sense of shame that filled his head and his heart. In the same week, I took my car, with its almost 600,000 kilometres on the clock, to Behan's garage in Castledermot for an overhaul. While Mick was working on the engine, a woman approached me and spoke those dreaded words. "You don't know me, do you?" In the almost 40 years since I finished my brief career as a secondary teacher in the technical school in Castledermot, I faced that question with regularity, and the passage of time has made it ever more frightening. The names and features of the fresh-faced young men and women I taught have over the years transmuted, like my own, into the faces of different people. Older, of course, and lived in. The experiences of the years showing. Faces tanned by sun and washed by rain, lined by worry, and then made young again by falling snow. I looked the woman in the eyes, and where a decade ago I might have gone in circles before stammering an effort at some name, I said politely, "I'm sorry, I don't." She offered her name, and suddenly the years stepped back and I recognised the face, the voice, the smile. We chatted for a while, filling in the ledger of lives and deaths. And then she said, "You know, the thing I remember most about your English classes was that you had a really accurate shot with a duster when people were daydreaming. You could land it in a cloud of chalk dust on any desk in the room, and I don't believe you ever hit anyone." "Let's be grateful for small mercies," I said. Later, driving home, the old engine of the car humming quietly, well-oiled and well-attended, I thought of my friend's email, and I thought about the woman's words in the garage, and about the few hundred students who had passed through my prefab room between 1974 and 1980. I thought of the theatre group we created, of the trips to Stratford-on-Avon, buses to the Abbey Theatre, Gary Wall singing Fernando unaccompanied at one of our concerts, one of the bravest young men I have ever met. Noel Lamb playing the Traveller in a short Super 8 film we made of Clifford T. Ward's song of the same name. John Costigan bringing a class to a laughing halt with some quick reply to a question of mine. Anne O'Neill singing Lost in France and making us believe for those few minutes that she truly was. I thought of the plays we staged, the basketball leagues, the chats when Byron's poems led us through the pathless woods, which were much more interesting than anything on the syllabus. Of the fact that I hadn't told any of the students I was leaving, and instead just slipped away one summer into another career. A silence I later regretted. But my mind kept returning to my friend's email, and the woman's memory of the accuracy of my duster throwing. And I hoped with all my heart, and still hope with all my heart, that I never humiliated anyone who sat in that prefab with its poster-covered walls of Dylan Thomas poems and student verses. Most of all, I hope that when the dust of recollection settles, the memories of those former students are good ones, and that they'll forgive my not always recognising them.
I was lost in France, in the fields the birds were singing. I was lost in France, and the day beginning.
October night drive, Duloch. Tawny, amber, a late night turf fire smoulder. The tint of wool dyed with crottle scraped from rocks. Rooibos tea, waxed mahogany. Corrugated rust worn to lace on the roof of an old stone shed. Iron oxide pigment, powdered cinnamon. The favoured shade of Georges de la Tour, and what wonder, he being the master of half-light and shadow, the flicker of candle over rich orange worsted. No name but itself, as it is and will be, unruffled along the side of this road, until the next beam of light combs it through, the colour of the bracken that moved me almost to tears.
In the Fez Medina, the locals are buying live chickens hand over fist. Amid the hustle and bustle of this part of the Moroccan city known as Fez El Bali, Old Fez, here we are on a November morning, wandering through what is one of the largest medieval centres in the world. I'm visiting Fez with a friend. It's a short break and we're here for just 3 nights, but determined to cram in as much as we possibly can. So, after a late night arrival, we are here in the old city the next morning, and with the help of our guide, attempting to make sense of the myriad alleyways and the narrowed cobbled lanes that make up the 9,400 streets of the Medina. Yes, that's right. There really are 9,400 passageways in this ancient city centre maze. It's the day before Milad un-Nabi, the holy day in the Muslim calendar that celebrates the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, a day when shops and businesses close and families all get together to eat, hence the run on the chickens. And as you stroll along one of the walkways, it's too tight for vehicles here, you'll find, say, a butcher's, then right next door, perhaps a man making and selling copper pans. Next to that, some necklaces for sale. Then maybe a huckster's cafe, followed by another butcher's with live squawking chickens. And beside that, maybe an outlet with the most magnificently styled and bejewelled wedding dresses. It's an absolute assault on the senses and utterly intoxicating. And all the while, there will be men with carts laden with olives or oranges or spices or prickly pears, all pushing their way through the crowds or setting up their stalls in their tried and tested pitches inside the old walls. This isn't my first Moroccan visit, but it's my first time in Fez, a city that has long fascinated me. It's the oldest of the country's imperial cities, and was known throughout the centuries as the cultural and religious heart of Morocco. It was in Fez that the movement for independence began, and it is a city that has always left its mark when it comes to people power. In November, the tourist quota is very low, giving us a great opportunity to observe the city in its true colours. Perhaps it's simply the time of year, but I find Fez to be far less touristy and commercial than my first experience of Marrakesh well over a decade ago. There are no gimmicks in Fez. What you see is real, not dressed up for the tourists. And all the locals we encounter, the Fassis, are welcoming, polite, extremely charming, and simply delighted that we are visiting their city. Back in the Medina itself, and feeling our senses assaulted at every turn as our guide takes us expertly through the maze, there is nonetheless one particular wow moment. Leading us here and there, down alleyways and around corners, our guide eventually takes us into a leather shop. Past the handbags we go, up the narrow stairs, and on, past rails of soft as putty leather jackets. Then, pushing our way through hanging fabrics that act as a curtain, we emerge onto an outdoor balcony, and there, down below us, and for as far as the eye can see, is the Chuara Tannery, the largest tannery in the city. Looking for all the world like a giant version of an artist's tray of paints, what it actually is an array of stone containers filled with various coloured dyes. In each of these containers, men are standing, waist deep in the dye, tending to the various hides being soaked and treated. Many of the dyes are vegetable or spice-based, so red is from poppies, yellow saffron, green mint, and so forth. It is the most extraordinary sight, a centuries-old vista, right here in 21st century Morocco. On our last afternoon in the city, the rains come, and then, as darkness falls, the deluge stops, and we decide to venture forth, without a guide this time, into the heart of the Medina. As we round a corner, we are suddenly joined from the left by two young men. "Are we okay?" they ask. "Do we want to see the mosque? It's the holy day and locals are heading for evening prayers." Conversing in French with the boys as we walk together, one of them asks where we come from. "Irlande," I reply. There's a moment's pause, and then their faces light up. "Ah," the smaller one says. And I am waiting for the follow-up, for one of the responses I usually encounter, albeit in other more developed places around the world. Bono, perhaps, or Liam Neeson, or, particularly in this soccer-mad country, maybe it will even be George Best. But no. Instead, the young man grins at us and makes a fist. "Ah," he says as the penny drops, "Conor McGregor!" All we can do is laugh. Even in this old-as-time city, where biblical scenes greet you at every turn, Fez's ability to stand still in such a fast-moving modern world will soon, it seems, be a thing of the past.
I was working as a busboy in a London club. It was my job to clear the tables, load the dishwasher, and make sure the waitresses had enough glasses to go round. No one would call it glamorous, but for some reason I loved it, and I was early to work every day. And noticing this, the manager gave me an upgrade and a wage rise, and put me in charge of the backstage rider. The rider was basically a list of supplies which the performers requested for their dressing room. And so each evening my first task was to call into the office, collect the list, and carefully assemble, and then deliver the order. Bottles of beer, bottles of sparkling water. Sometimes the call was for a couple of litres of red wine. And for the older performers, I'd bring back scotch or rum or a bottle of gin and a lemon. The other busboys and some of the waitresses thought that I had somehow bagged myself the most prestigious job of all. While they were running around answering the call of the regular Joes, I was, they imagined, sitting backstage, hobnobbing with the stars. But I soon realised that my job was simply to quench the thirst of a bunch of faded old rockers. Occasionally, a younger, more vital band would arrive, only to reveal themselves in the privacy of the dressing room to be just as dull and witless as the forebears they dreamed of replacing. And then one evening, I was told that we had a special guest, an unannounced superstar, who was due to join the main act for a song or two, and who should, they said, be treated like royalty. Bob Dylan was coming. The request from his management was simple. He wasn't a big drinker, but a bottle of red wine and a couple of beers would, we were told, be appreciated. Some crisps would also be good. But I was having none of it. I borrowed a pencil from one of the waitresses and took the list into the changing room. Crisps? You can't give Bob Dylan crisps. This is the man who wrote Like a Rolling Stone, for God's sake. This is the man who wrote Mr. Tambourine Man and Tangled Up in Blue, and you're going to feed him crisps. By now I had worked myself into a righteous frenzy. If this club thought that crisps constituted a proper food for the voice of a generation, then it was my job to save them from themselves. Cheese and onion, salt and vinegar, not on my watch. I added a request for chicken wings, deep-fried squid and spring rolls, and handed it into the kitchen. Before I went to the bar, I supplemented the drinks order with a bottle of bourbon and a rare and expensive bottle of tequila. I collected everything, tottered backstage with a series of plates and trays, and then sat down to wait. And I didn't wait long. The manageress tapped lightly on the door and ushered in a small man wearing dark glasses and a hoodie. I'd seen recent pictures of Mr. Dylan, and he seemed these days to be wearing hoodies rather a lot. I was not prepared, however, for how short he was. Wasn't Bob Dylan about 5'8"? And here, up close and personal, he seemed little more than 5'5". and his nose seemed smaller and flatter. He looked more like a boxer than the great eagle of the Midwest that I had been expecting. But the hair, or what I could see of it at least, was unmistakable. The hood was up, but there was a trademark curl to the grey-brown frizz that reached across his brow. "Come on," I said to myself. "You can't meet Bob Dylan and then complain that he doesn't look properly bobbish." With a brief, "This is Chris, he'll look after you," the manageress left, and for a moment, our guest peered around the room. He hung his coat on the back of the door, took off his dark glasses, and sat in a plastic chair. "Did you make this?" he asked, looking at the buffet. "No, they make it in the kitchen. I just bring it here and set it up." Giving a job description to Bob Dylan made the whole thing seem more tragic than I could have imagined, but he didn't appear to mind. "And what would you recommend?" "I don't know," I said. "People like the squid." He nodded. "Yeah." There was a brief pause. "People always do." He took a piece from its plate and bit into it before nodding again. "Seeing as you're the guy with the taste," he turned to me and smiled, "maybe you could recommend something else. Which guitar would you go for?" He pointed towards the far wall where 8 or 9 acoustic guitars had been set up. I recognised the names but was already out of my depth. "You can't go wrong with a Martin," I said, pretending to know. "You're right again," he laughed, picking up the one that I had pointed to and passing it to me. "What are we going to play?" This was the one part of the whole experience that I had prepared for. I'd had this dream 1,000 times. And so we launched straight into I Shall Be Released. And then followed it with a quick One Too Many Mornings. And finally a version of Albert Frank Baddow's Copper Kettle. The final chord was still ringing out when the manageress tapped again. "He's not coming, James," she said to my fellow guitarist. The hooded stranger, who was now apparently calling himself James, looked up and laughed. "How come?" The manageress shrugged. "There's a strike or something. He's still in Rome." And she went. James put down his guitar and, taking his coat with one hand, reached the other out towards me. "Nice playing with you, kid," he said. "You got a right hand like a sledgehammer." I was still in a state of shock, wondering who I'd spent the last half hour bonding with. A sledgehammer. Is that a good thing? "Damn right," James laughed. "That's how Leadbelly used to play. See you around." So the band went on that evening without their special guest, and I got home at about 2 a.m. And I sat on the bed, drinking the bottle of tequila that I'd borrowed from the dressing room. And a few of the great man's words came to me from Ballad of a Thin Man. And they made sense to me as they never had before. "Something is happening here," the song goes, "and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones?" And I tried to picture Bob Dylan waiting at Rome International Airport. And I thought to myself, no, I have no idea what's happening here. I have no idea at all.
Surfing. Mother likes to slumber in the car, head back in the passenger seat, eyes shut. Still in the first year of her widowhood, she listens to hear Tommy's voice again. I walk quickly towards the burrow, 20 minutes of respite to stretch my legs and take the air before we drive back to the parlour, an evening of quizzes and soap operas. A seal surfs near the forlorn point, pale, dappled belly up. It rolls and falls on the tide towards the shore, then dives beneath and surfaces out at sea. I scramble through gravel and war, stand on the shore and call the seal, yodel a tune to lure it in. I want one sign. the seal rides the waves again. The ice cream shop is closed today, so I bring her the seal story. She sings with the radio as we head for home. Angels guard thee, sweet love, till morn.
On this morning's programme, we heard Close Encounters of the Deeply Unsatisfying Kind by Conall Hamill, Dusters by John McKenna, October Night Drive, Duloch, a poem by Geraldine Mitchell, In the Fez Medina by Rosalind Dee, Knock Knock Knocking on Someone's Door by Chris McCallum, and Surfing, a poem by A.M. Cousins. The music was Fame Will Eat the Soul by Van Morrison with Bill Medley of the Righteous Brothers, Lost in France by Bonnie Tyler, Mood Indigo by Duke Ellington and his orchestra, No Borders by Malika Zara, and Knock Knock Knocking on Heaven's Door by Bob Dylan. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy. To listen back to this morning's programme, see rte.ie/radio1/Sunday Miscellany.
RTE Radio 1.